I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. Here are some headlines of the articles I read in preparation for today's show. How improvisation changes the brain. Improv training can help you cope with uncertainty. How improv makes you more confident and less anxious. The mental health benefits of improv. How can we fix our empathy deficit? The answer, improv. Well, improv is built around two words, yes and. When two people are improvising a scene together, they accept whatever scenario their partner offers, and then they add to it. Now, that sounds simple, and in some ways it is, but it means shutting down the voices in your head, listening, paying attention, helping your partner, and making them look good. Now, we generally associate improv with theater and comedy, but it has psychological benefits for all of us. So today on the show, how improv can help us connect with others, unlock creativity, manage uncertainty, learn to play, and have this thing called fun. Let me introduce our three guests. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Jennifer Childs. She is co-founder and executive director of 1812 Productions, which happens to be the only professional theater company in the country dedicated to comedy. She's a playwright, an actor, and a writer. And Jennifer, always fun to talk with you, especially about something like improv.
So good to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Danigal Young is a social psychologist, is a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, author most recently of a book titled Wrong about misinformation, and she's an improv comedian with Comedy Sports Philadelphia. Danigal, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Thanks, Marty.
And joining us from Florida, I do believe, is Clay Drinko. He's an educator. He writes about improv for Psychology Today and is the author of two books about improv, the latest titled Play Your Way Sane. And Clay Drinko, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with yes and. And perhaps, Danigal, I'll start with you. Why is that so central to improv? Yes and, those two words.
So we say that when you say yes and, you are accepting the offer that has just been given by your scene partner, and you're building upon it. And what I like about the simplicity of yes and is that not only do you have to acknowledge what your scene partner has just said, but you have to respond just to the last bit of the offer that they have given. And so often in life and in our information environment, we're not actually responding to the last thing that was said, and we're usually not listening. Mm-hmm. Usually we're just waiting to talk. So I think the idea of yes and is you're listening and processing and building upon just the offer that they gave.
You know, Jennifer, I was thinking in putting the show together that how often I will say no, but for some kind of not an improv offer, but just an offer in life. And I kind of feel like we live in a no but time.
Absolutely. No, it feels also, I feel like we're conditioned to find the problems with something that somebody, an offer that somebody gives us. Well, that can't work because, and there's a zillion reasons, but what's really exciting about not only improvising when you're on stage or in the studio making things, but in day-to-day life, like with your staff, with your board, with your husband, with your family, that really exciting things can come out of that yes-anding that you would never have invented yourself.
Clay, let me get you in on the conversation. What are some of them, those psychological underpinnings? I think we touched on that briefly, but to improv, I mean, what does it tap into that is beyond theater and even beyond comedy?
Part of it is this shift that improvisers have to do with their focus. You know, if I'm improvising, I don't know what's going to happen, right? I don't know what my scene partner is going to do. So I have to really give everything I have, all my focus on really paying attention. And that frees me up to not have to worry about, you know, do I look silly? Is this working? Is this not working? Do I have something stuck in my teeth? and so it really, that simple shift in focus really frees you up to be less anxious, less in your head, and also to boost confidence and creativity, because that conscious part of your brain can only do a super limited amount of things at once. And so if you're focused only on the things and the people around you, you can't also be doing all that, you know, stuck in your head activity.
You're nodding your head, Danicle, and I think we're all nodding our head. I mean, the idea, it seems, again, so simple, but when you focus on another person, you're not focusing on yourself.
Mm-hmm. The idea, I love how Clay just put that, that shift in focus to that moment and the people around you and where you are in that moment, which is so antithetical to how we live our lives all the time, where, you know, I talk about how my head is always buzzing with all of the things I'm trying to, like, pay attention to and monitor and thinking about my kids and my job and my house. But when you are in the middle of an improv game, your job is simply to listen to your partner and to make them look good and to respond to what they've said, and the whole world does fall away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when a show is over, I just can't believe it, because I'm like, how was that 90 minutes? Where did it go? Because you're laser focused on these really tangible aspects of the present moment in a way that maybe you do when you meditate, maybe you do when you do yoga. But outside of that, I've never had that same experience.
Well, Clay, you've written about that experience where you'll do an improv scene and you sort of wonder, what just happened? Because I have no memory of what that experience was about.
Yeah. It happened to me fairly early on. I had been improvising for just a couple years. And, you know, we were fortunate enough to have our college improv group, like, be super popular. And so I would be nervous before the shows. And then we'd walk around and say, like, I got your back. And then the next thing I would remember, the show was over. And so that really caused me to sort of put a pin in that mystery of, like, what is happening. It kind of seems scary and bad because there's an hour of my life that I don't remember.
Right.
But when I would look back on the tapes, I was the best version of myself. I was not at all anxious. I was so in the moment and confident and quick and funny, and all the things I would love to be every single second of every day. And so that's why I set out to understand, you know, what is that that's happening?
I mean, are you saying that in a sense you disappeared?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is that your ego disappears, right? So there's right now they're really starting to uncover this idea of the default mode network, which is when you're not doing anything, those are the parts of the brain that are active. So your brain is still working even when you're not doing anything. And that's sort of the daydreaming. For me, my default mode network is a lot of, like, going over lists and thinking about all the things I need to do. And so the default mode network, they're starting to find, actually decreases in activity with things like meditation, with things like improv, also with things like psilocybin. So I think there's really a lot of interesting research happening right now about this. And for me, that's one of the keys to understanding it is, like, call it whatever you will, but your ego is quieter, your self-referential thoughts are quieter, and that frees you up to be in the moment and to be creative.
Jen, I'm curious about why we associate improv with comedy. And I know you can't push comedy. You can't try to be funny, right? I mean, that just doesn't work in comedy. What is the connection there?
I think there's something about the fact that that's instantaneous, that it is. So in that way, it's surprising. I mean, that's one of the main things that comedy does is it surprises you because it comes out of nowhere. And, you know, both Dana and I performed with Comedy Sports, which is short form improvisation, right, which is there's a lot of gimmick games, you know, that are geared towards having a comic outcome. But again, the rules are still the same. You're still with your partner. You're still actively listening and working with them to make something. So you can't be in your head going, like, oh, I bet it's going to be really funny if I say this next.
Oh, you just can't do that.
No. It's death. And,
that's hard. Isn't that hard to just turn that off?
I think it's once you're in, you know, everybody asked when I first joined Comedy Sports, and I don't know if you got this as well, how can you rehearse improv? Rehearsing improv, why do you do that? And it's a part of it is kind of training your body to say yes and more, training your body to actively listen, training your brain not to go, oh, that was a really great line. I bet 3 lines from now if I say this, so that you're then out of that moment. And So yeah, I mean, I feel like it's in that training. I love what you said about your ego goes away, because that is it. And especially for somebody who started out as a performer, ego was very, very present.
I think we can all claim having oversized egos, Jen. Let me go to you, Danigal, because what I hear all three of you saying is it's about giving up control.
Yeah, it's about giving up control. And I think that note about the ego disappearing from both of you was really so powerful, because I have found that my worst performances in improv, and I mean worst in the sense that not necessarily that they weren't funny, but that I never actually got to that transcendent space where my ego disappeared. It's when there are people who say, I'm going to be coming to your show and I'm really excited to see it. Mm. And especially if they're like my students or colleagues, people who don't know me in a play space, I can't get out of my head. It's like I can't be present in the moment, because what I'm doing is I'm engaging in this sort of like self-referential monitoring where I'm like, what are they thinking about what I'm doing? And as soon as you enter that space, you're dead. Like that, it really, it does. It just destroys your ability to be in your physical body, just listening and responding.
I mean, is there something you can do to sort of turn that off?
I mean, it's happened in the past where I'm like, Dana, you got to shut that out. Like, you got to be, just like, forget it. Be here now. You're going to look ridiculous. You're going to make funny noises. They're your colleagues. They're going to get over it. Like, just move on. But it is tricky.
And it's about the other person, I find. Mm-hmm. It's like, if I'm thinking about the fact that my daughter's watching me and what does she think about me, I just have to look at the other person on stage with me and go, I'm going to be all about you.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Clay, we have about a minute before our break here. I'd be curious what you want to add to what Danigal and Jen were just saying.
For me, it's also about giving myself permission to be messy and to not be perfect. And a lot of that for me is linked with expectations. So if I'm expecting to put on a really great show for my friends, it will be awful. But if I just give myself permission to get silly, to get stupid, to make a mess, to just go wild, then that frees me up to be really in the moment and to not be thinking about expectations, but just be thinking about, I'm going to have fun. I'm going to be childlike. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation here on The Connection. And we're talking about improv and what improv can teach us about being spontaneous, about showing up, about supporting our partner, and about life itself. That is Clay Drinko. He's an educator, and he writes about improv for Psychology Today. His most recent book is Play Your Way Sane. Danigal Young is a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, author of a book most recently called Wrong, and that's about misinformation. She's an improv comedian with Comedy Sports Philadelphia. And Jennifer Childs, co-founder and executive director of 1812 Productions. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. On the show today, we're talking about improv, how it can help us get out of ourselves, get out of our way, help us listen, deal with uncertainty, unlock creativity, and connect with others. And again, talking with Jennifer Childs, Danigal Young, and Clay Drinko. Clay, let me go back to you, because I think either read or saw an interview you were in, and you said one thing about improv is that you are not special. You are not the star. And I just wanted to have you expand on that. And then we're going to have Jen and Danigal do a little demo for us. But dig deeper in that for us, because I really like that, Clay.
This is perhaps the hardest lesson for me and many other people.
Right.
But improv is a total group activity. There cannot be a superstar. There cannot be a diva. And I think that's such an important life lesson as well. And so I think a lot about sort of despecialing myself. What are ways that I can stop thinking about myself and my agenda as the most important? And instead try to figure out what other people are interested in or want, and why do they think that, and being more curious about that. And it really is, I think, especially today, it's really evident in so many places that so many people have, you know, have this idea that what is going to be good for them is only going to be good for them. Like, and they have to look out for themselves. And it's this really individual way of thinking about things. And for me, that's the reverse of the way that we should be headed. If we're thinking about what is good for as many people as possible, it's a real shift in your brain to tell yourself you do not matter more than anyone else. And then one of my examples of this is, you know, when you're getting off of an airplane and there's like that two or three people who just like run and push. And to me, that is like, wow, like, everybody wants to get off this plane. And maybe someone has a story, like maybe they really have a reason, right? I don't know their story. But to me, that's an example of like, I have that instinct too. I want to get out of there. I have social anxiety. Get me out of here. But I have to remind myself, like, you are no more special than anyone else. And that frees me up to look around and be like, wow, that person with the 6-month-old baby definitely wants to get out of here too. And wow, look at that person over there. Look how patient they're being. And it just, it puts you in the world instead of just being all about you and in your head and what your agenda is.
Yeah, the kind of star of your own movie. Jen, you want to add to that, or Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about looking around the environment and also considering possibilities. That I love the airplane image.
Right.
Mine is
we
always
all know,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Mine is always like the cars that, you know, speed past me on my bicycle, that they have to get to the next red light where I can pass them again as I go very slowly. But it's that idea of starting to become curious also about your environment and curious about the other people, so that you're not, that you don't have blinders on. And I feel like, I don't know how curious we are.
Oh, interesting. We know everything, right?
Yeah.
Or we think we do. Mm-hmm. Daniel, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that especially in, I think about everything in our political world, Marty. I'm sorry.
I know,
but
you do.
But especially in the political moment that we're in right now, there is a lot of self-focus. And, you know, I think so much about what would happen if we brought some of the practices and values of improv into our, the way that politics are discussed, especially by political elites, with a kind of humility and a listening. Imagine if there were a show like Crossfire, but where people were actually listening to and responding to the last offer given. Like, I can't even imagine it,
no.
Right? Because that's not what our information environment incentivizes. We incentivize the production of content. We don't incentivize listening to content. So, yeah, I just think there's so many possible extensions of these principles.
Well, we've been talking about improv, but I think for our listeners' sake, it'd be interesting just to do a little something. And I'm going to toss this over to you, Jen, and you and Daniel are just going to demonstrate a little bit for our listeners and for myself and for Clay as well.
Well, this is just an exercise to kind of get to the root of yes and. And it's a beginner's exercise, and we do it a lot, not just with other improvisers, but we do it like I said, in the boardroom, with the administration, with any kind of team that you're working with. And so basically, Marty, just give me an object that Dana and I are going to invent an object together. So just give me an object, just a plain object.
A cup.
A cup. So this first round, Dana and I'm going to start by saying, hey, let's invent a new kind of cup. And Dana's first response is going to be, and I will say, then this cup is blue. And then Dana will respond, our first word has to be no, and then she will give her offer.
Okay.
And then I will say no and give mine.
Okay.
And we'll just go back and forth a little bit like that.
Okay.
So, Dana, let's invent a new kind of cup that is made out of silly putty.
No, it's not going to hold liquid, Jen.
Well, no, it could hold liquid if we really tried to make it hold liquid.
No, but it's already been done, and the market doesn't even need it.
No, I don't believe it's been done, and I think it needs, the world needs one.
No, look at all the Stanley cups that are already out there.
Great. So, what got invented?
Nothing. Nothing.
So,
right.
Now we do it again, and this time the first words out of our mouth have to say, yes, but. Dana, let's invent a new kind of cup that is edible.
Yes, but if it's edible, then all the water will fall out.
Yes, but we could maybe construct some kind of, I don't know, liquid blocking invention to make it, you know, better.
Yes, but that would probably be toxic and give people disease.
Yes, but we could sort of cure diseases.
Yes, but...
Okay, so what got invented? Nothing. And my friend Dave Jadico, who's an amazing improviser, always said, yes, but is no with a smile.
I love that.
It's a way of politely saying, no, thank you. And now, with yes and, we say, Dana, let's invent a new kind of cup that is neon.
Yes, and we can have lights on the bottom that, like, reflect off of the table.
Yes, and those lights could spell out your name so you never wonder which cup is yours.
Yes, and because it's personalized, then no one will get germs or transmit COVID anymore.
Yes, and we will have then solved all the world's problems. Thank you, CDC. Okay, so what got invented? A lot.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
And something we never would have invented on our own.
Right, right. Clay, you want to weigh in on that? I know you when we were talking before the show began, and you thought you might do sound effects. I don't think you needed to do that. But nonetheless, what did you hear?
That was my specialness trying to shine through. I'm like, I want to be in it.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
I heard an energy shift for sure in the last one with the yes and, which I think is also part of it, right? When you're like, I am just going to embrace and go along with everything, I could hear that energy shift. It felt lighter. It felt childlike. It felt exciting. But the other really important thing that just was recently started to be discovered about butts is that there was a study that showed with like biological markers, people interpret the word butt biologically as like a social rejection. Huh. And so I think that's really fascinating because for a long time, I would be taking improv classes or doing a scene, and yes, but can work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can work, and the scene keeps going, and it doesn't really, it doesn't really stop things like just a flat out no can. And so I really was curious about why is yes and better? And I think we're starting to figure it out now that when people hear but, it is as if they are being rejected, right? As if their idea is being like canceled out, even though yes came right before it. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. I remember being told that when someone speaks and they use the word but in the middle of a sentence, not improv, ignore everything before the but. Which is kind of, Clay, what you were saying there, right?
Yeah.
It's a rejection.
It hits you differently. It is a rejection, right? And I have that in my real life. If I say, oh, I have this really good idea, and my coworker says, oh, yeah, but if we did it this way, I'm like, no.
That's great. Let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Clay Drinko. He writes about improv for Psychology Today. He's an educator. He's written a couple of books about improv, the latest one titled Play Your Way Sane. Danigal Young is a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware. Her most recent book is titled Wrong, and it's about misinformation. She's also an improv comedian with Comedy Sports Philadelphia. And Jennifer Childs has studied with Comedy Sports Philadelphia, and she is the co-founder, executive director of 1812 Productions. And I said it once, but I'll say it again, the only professional theater company in the country dedicated to comedy. She's also an actor, writer, and a playwright. Clay, let me go back to you and actually something that you wrote in Psychology Today about a guy named Keith Johnstone. And I guess in the world of improv, he was a very important person. And you talked about going to one of his classes or interviewing him for your doctoral dissertation, and you went up to do an exercise, and he stopped you before you even said one word. What did he say to you?
Yeah, he said that I was pre-scripting and to go back and erase everything in my head and do it the right way.
Wow. And how did he know that? Do you know how he knew that?
Yeah, he could see. He could tell. Like, you can see it when someone has an agenda. When someone is like, oh, I'm going to go out, I'm going to do this cool thing, and the scene's going to be amazing. And it was tough for me in that moment.
Bet. Because
at that stage, I had been, I had so much experience doing improv. I'd been doing it for decades. And so to really get called out like that was tough, but incredible. And I refer back to that moment all the time now, even with my teaching. You know, if someone is in their head, like I want to call them out as in a nice way, as fast as I can, to get to that more spontaneous, creative, playful way of existing.
Well, I have to say both Dan Agola and Jen sort of were laughing, but I think in sympathy with you for being called out.
Go ahead, Dan. So the same thing happened. Jen and I both trained under my late husband, Mike Young, and he was the director of comedy sports for a long time. And when I first got into the company, I was about 23 years old, and I wanted to succeed, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted to get an A in improv. And so I would get on stage, because I'm a student and now I'm a professor. I would get on stage and I'd be like, okay, I'm Sally and you're my brother and your name is Jacob and we're in a barn and we're scooping manure and oh, there's a conflict because you don't want to scoop as much manure as I have to scoop. I mean, it really, because I didn't want to have to learn all of these things. I was not particularly high in tolerance for ambiguity, like I think we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I just remember Mike being like, okay, Dana, let's do that again, but this time just give one offer. And then you have to respond to what the other person says. Like, stop scripting, start listening. And it was so humbling. And I actually now think about performing improv that way. And I'm like, wow, that must have been burdensome that I felt like I had to carry all of that, because really, you don't have to do any of that. Yeah. You just have to respond to the last thing that someone said and then make them look good. That's it.
Yeah. And he married you anyway.
And he married me anyway. Pretty lucky. Yeah.
And you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah,
maybe tales of Jen Childs?
Well, there have been many. But I think some of it, for me at least, had to do with fear, at least in the beginning, and that idea of fear of the unknown, and like if I can get some of these building blocks around me, then I'll be fine. And this may lead into some of the other conversations. One of my favorite exercises, it was not my favorite to do, but it's one of those that it was like an aha for me, is it was a death in a minute, two people on stage, a 1 minute scene. The only rule is that sometime during the scene one of them has to die, and inevitably everybody would leave the death until like the last 5 or 3 seconds, because nobody wanted to be stuck on stage by themselves. Mm-hmm. And the challenge then was to have the death happen in the first 5 seconds, because we know it's going to happen. So get it out of the way. And then you're in the unknown. And yes, in the unknown, there is space for failure, but there is also mm-hmm. space for brilliance and invention. And so having that little extra push to kind of push past your fear and go mm-hmm. like, what's the worst that can happen?
Right.
You know, so.
Clay, let me go back to you and talk about ambiguity, uncertainty, because I think we're in that part of the conversation here. How does improv help us deal with that? Which is very existential, right? I mean, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow?
Yeah, I think of it's pretty tied in with anxiety. And so studies show that improv helps, not with everyone, but generally lowers anxiety and generally helps people increase their uncertainty tolerance. And for me, it's a kind of exposure therapy. That's how I look at it. Because what we were saying earlier is this idea that you're rewarded for stepping into it, something that you're very afraid of, right? Like, instead of pre-scripting the whole scene and having a really subpar scene as a result, instead you do what your improv teacher tells you and you just say one thing and then have no idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then your scene partner has your back. They're going to say something. And then it starts to feel incredible. And the humor comes organically out of it. You start surprising and delighting yourself. Like, you can't believe what you just said. You can't believe what your partner said. And you're so in sync, not all the time, but sometimes, that is a reward for wanting to step into that uncertainty again.
Danielle, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so the idea of ambiguity tolerance is, you know, in my own academic research, it's something that shows up a lot, especially in political science work, because ambiguity tolerance is actually associated with more liberal beliefs on social and cultural issues, which I think is really interesting. So people who are high in tolerance for ambiguity, these are folks who will respond that they're comfortable with situations that are uncertain. They don't need the world around them to be predictable. They're okay being exposed to stories or things that people say that might have multiple meanings. Like, they kind of enjoy that. They enjoy sort of riddle solving, right? So in some work that I did in 2016, we found that that tolerance for ambiguity was associated with more tolerant attitudes, more positive attitudes towards transgender people and transgender rights. And that was even controlling for everything under the sun, every kind of political attitude and media exposure. But there's something, and this makes sense when you think about if you are tolerant of things that are uncertain or that are not black and white, then the idea that perhaps gender is a social construction and operates on a spectrum is something that you might be comfortable with. And also, what I like about tolerance for ambiguity cognitively is that it leaves an individual more open to still acquiring information and being okay without landing on a decision, a judgment, or an evaluation right away. So in contrast, folks who are high in need for closure, they need the story to end. They need to know what's going on. And those folks end up being more susceptible to misinformation and conspiracy theories.
So that really fits neatly into what we're talking about when it comes to improv. We're almost up on a break here, but Jen, do you get scared doing improv? Does it scare you?
Yes. I mean, there's usually nervousness. I don't know that scary is the right word, really. There are so many other things in the world to be scared of right now. I'm like, please just put me on stage and give me a suggestion that I can handle. No, I still get nervous if I've been away from it for a while. But again, you're out there with other people. You're not by yourself.
And there are rules and games and things. So it's not like make it up, you know, there's nothing. You're just given nothing to work with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, I have found actually it was great training for the pandemic because it was talk about ambiguity and where are we, and is, you know, running an organization that is all about bringing people together and, you know, so it was great training for that.
Well, I'll tell you what, another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about improv today on The Connection. That is Jennifer Childs, also with us Danigal Young and Clay Drinko. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And again, our guests are Jennifer Childs, co-founder and artistic director of 1812 Productions, Danigal Young, a social psychologist at the University of Delaware, author and improv comedian, and Clay Drinko. He's an educator, author of Play Your Way Sane, and writes about improv for Psychology Today. Clay, let me just go back to you, and you referenced this earlier, and I wanted to pick up on it about how what we know, at least so far, about how the brain reacts when someone is doing improv. What does that tell us? What do we know so far?
Yeah, the cognitive science answer, part of it, and I'm not a cognitive scientist, is that there's a part of the brain, they did some brain scans on freestyle rappers, jazz musicians, as well as improv comedians. And a similarity seems to be that the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex decreases in activity during improv versus doing something scripted. And a part called the medial prefrontal cortex increases in activity. Hmm. For me, this is kind of a metaphor because I'm not a scientist, perhaps. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex has been linked with that sort of inner judge or inner critic, that sort of self-thinking And the medial prefrontal cortex is linked with language and creativity. This is a huge oversimplification. There's other parts of the brain. There's networks in the brain. And I'm constantly writing about that type of stuff and trying to teach myself as I go. But I think that just that metaphor that this one, you know, example, one part of the brain decreases and one increases feels really similar, you know, to my experience on stage. The thing that we talked about earlier of like not needing to remember who I was or what was going on and being totally free. So it makes sense as a metaphor for me.
Well, and I was reading also a little bit about dopamine and pleasure. I mean, I don't want to go too out on a limb here, Clay, but just there's some really interesting research that's being done looking at this.
Yeah. I mean, it's all those things that are happening with the default mode network, with decreases in stress, with decreases in anxiety, and then all those parts of the brain, like in the default mode network, have been linked with like irregularities. With that, are linked with depression and anxiety and OCD. So it just seems like there's a lot of links that we're just now starting to figure out, and we're really fortunate because when I did my dissertation in grad school about improv and cognitive science, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, there was really not very much research being done specifically about theatrical improv. And now there's so much being done, at least in comparison. So it's really an exciting time. Yeah. Like we're really starting to see some proof of something that improvisers have known forever, right?
Well, and Jen, let me go on. Speaking of the brain, let's do the body. I mean, I feel like with improv, or even, I guess, acting itself, it's breathing. It's being aware of where you are, right, on a stage or in a place.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's, for me, those two things are very, very connected, because if I'm too in my head, I can't be in my body. And the freedom that you're talking about, Clay, I find that has its... that once, you know, I remove that barrier in my brain of going like, I must succeed, I must do well, I must get an A, I can then be really fully myself. And my body relaxes, it doesn't hurt as much, things like that, you know? So yeah, definitely.
Same for you, Danny?
I actually, as you were saying this, I was thinking about teaching. I think one of the reasons that, you know, I probably perform like once every 3 months now with Comedy Sports. And I used to need it like regularly because it was an outlet for me to be, it was like my meditation, my yoga. And now I feel like because I'm in front of the class and right now I'm teaching two giant classes, 150 students in one and 100 in the other. And I'm always using these muscles. And I do find that if I am being self-critical or if I am holding myself to a really high standard, I'm not present in the moment. I'm not able to respond. And what makes the class really good is when I can see on their faces that they're not understanding something and I can immediately pivot and be like, let's try a whole new example. Let's try this one. And then but that requires responding to an offer that's been given and listening. And that is what teaching is. When it's done well, you're responding to the signals they're giving you, and you're changing your offer in return.
Yeah, and one can see how that would work in a workplace. I mean, so many different venues. Jen, you want to
totally. But you were, you know, when you talked about the body, we often think of offers as being verbal, and you know, and they're not often in most of our lives, the offers that we see around us are physical offers, like how somebody holds their body, the look on their face, the way that they walk, or how they're moving slowly or quickly. Those are, and being attuned to the physical offers and the nonverbal offers, I think, is just as important.
Yeah, listeners can't see, but we keep giving each other offers here around the table, and I miss having Clay.
I know,
not in the studio, because those nonverbals of like the little nod or like a laugh or whatever, it suggests that something is resonating with you, and so you want to then build on that offer.
Danica, let me go back to you, and you mentioned your husband. Yeah. At the time, who I guess founded Comedy Sports Philadelphia, who died sadly.
Yep.
But he used improv to help yeah. with his death, I guess, with his grief, with well, giving to, up, or what?
So what I think is interesting, as we're talking about tolerance for ambiguity, and I talk about this an awful lot because it was a time period that was really pivotal for me, and also it shaped how I think about how to deal with crisis. So Mike was an expert improviser. And in 2005, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor that was benign, but that through complications did take his life. But yeah. in the process of about 7 months, he lost his short-term memory and his vision. And what that meant was that by through no choice of his own, he did only have the present moment, uh-huh. right? So for most of us, that would be a catastrophe, right? But for Mike, I think because he was so practiced in responding to just the last offer given, he never seemed, when he was in that period that lasted about 3 months, he never seemed frustrated or upset by it. He was always positive in his affect. And even before that, when he still kind of understood what was going on, he never, it was like, well, this is... You know, life doesn't define you. How you respond to life defines you. And yeah. so this is what I've been given, and so here's what we'll do.
Wow.
It was very present. And I was not okay with it. Like, I had to kind of learn from how he embraced the ambiguity, and that shaped how I then responded in kind. That, like, if I go down a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories, or if I stay in bed every day, like, that's antithetical to how he is mm-hmm. responding to this. But when in those moments when he had no short-term memory, to witness how he responded, like, if you'd say, you know, where are you? And he'd say, well, I'm in a hotel. And you'd say, but then why are there all of these wires and things? He's like, because it's a technologically advanced, really weird hotel.
It sounds like the improv you
right?
two are just
and
doing.
And it really, and that's literally what he'd say. And he'd yeah. say, and then, because his friends were always around, and he'd yeah. say, why else are all my friends here? You know, it was sort of a beautiful thing to witness, yeah. and it was so pure yeah. in what yeah. it was in that moment.
Picking up on that, I mean, Jen, we associate improv with comedy. Mm-hmm. Does it work with tragedy, or just, I mean, is that just clumsy?
No.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that if we look at improv as something that is only to make comedy happen, it robs it of a whole wealth and depth of other uses. And, you know, there's such a thing as long form comedy, where sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's not. But improvisations that will go on for, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. And that's about, you know, finding depth with each other and leaning into those relationships, leaning into those characters that you're creating in the same way that you're doing it in life. And whether it is, you know, facing a crisis situation or just living day-to-day life with your kids, with your family, with, you know, so many of the rules of improv. The rules of improv were read at my wedding by Megan Belwar.
Give us some rules.
Show, don't tell. Don't tell me what you're going to do. Show me what you're going to do.
Right.
Always start from yes. You know, add to the conversation. Don't make it the other person's job to come up with all of the, you know, that's where yes and comes. Yeah. Don't make it all about you have to do everything. And the idea that there are no mistakes, that there's only opportunities for deeper growth together.
Mm. Well, that's lovely. Yeah. Clay, let me go back to you. And I was thinking about kids. I mean, kids know about improv, right? what can we learn from kids?
And you have two
of them, don't you?
Yes, I have a 3 and almost 7-year-old, and a lot of my parenting is just improvising. but in the good way. Like, there's a real structure to it. There's a real strategy to it. Improv is a great way to help de-escalate conflict, especially with the toddler set. I think one of my examples was, you know, I think my oldest was 2 at the time, and she wanted an avocado, but she did not want me to peel it. And I could tell it was going to be a fight. So I stopped what my instinct was telling me, which is to explain that's not how we eat avocados. Right. And instead I went, okay, yeah, okay. And so I gave her the avocado. She took a bite and couldn't, right? Mm-hmm. And she said, cut, please. Right? And so,
right.
So I won. And so a lot of it.
Right, exactly. Point for you.
So a lot of it, though, is I realized I did an experiment in my early days of parenting of counting how many times I said no, mm-hmm. and then figuring out why was I saying no? Did I always have to say no? Sometimes I did to keep them alive, right? Mm-hmm. But then other times it was because I didn't want to make a mess. I didn't want the house to be messy, and I didn't want them to struggle. And so when I realized that, I went, oh, no. Life is incredibly difficult and messy. I need to let them struggle and make messes. And it really helped me shift to this more like yes and approach to parenting.
Yeah. And Danigal said, yes, that's so powerful.
I did because, you know, Clay, I have a 19-year-old and an almost 14-year-old now. And I think part of where they have had struggles is because when they were younger, I didn't want them to have to struggle.
Of course.
And so I would, you know, solve the problem for them or say, you know, no, that's not the way you do it. This is how you do it. And now, you know, realizing, oh, wow, that really robbed them of the opportunity to, you know, bite the avocado and realize that you can't bite the avocado. But we have conversations about it now, and we're all learning. We try to display that humility even as parents and say, look, we're doing the best we can, but now try to figure it out yourself.
Good advice there.
The next time my 20-year-old calls me from college and asks for money, I'm going to just tell her, you need to bite your own avocado.
a metaphor for many things in life. Jen, let me go back to you. Mm-hmm. And how much do you think improv is like jazz?
Is it? Yes, totally. And I mean, I think about like the history of when. So improv is kind of an, yes, there's Commedia dell'arte and all of that, but American improv and as we know it really came up in the 50s with the Compass Players, University of Chicago, Nichols and May, that sort of thing. And all of that was happening around the same time that jazz was becoming more of a movement and that like in stand-up comedy that Lenny Bruce, who speaks in a kind of jazz idiom is not the right word, but as kind of jazz cadence to his comedy, that really happened in the 50s. You know, at the beginning of the 50s, everything was ba-dum-bum-tsh.
Yeah.
And slowly it just became more and more free, both in music and comedy and improv. So I think they're very linked.
Because there are rules and things. It's not like everyone's just playing their own thing. There is something together. I'm looking at the clock here, and Clay, you know, I don't want people to go away thinking, well, improv is going to solve all the world's problems. Well, you know, we're going to connect, and we're not going to be anxious, and we're going to care about the other person more than we care about ourselves. I mean, what do you see as the possibilities for improv? And people just, they may not take a class, but they want to think about how they can live a better, maybe fuller, funner life.
Yeah, absolutely. It cannot solve all our problems, unfortunately. Life is always going to be messy and difficult. And I think really leaning into some of these improv skills help you be able to accept that. I think that's the ultimate yes and is, you know, this is my life right now. And what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the ultimate resilience builder, right? Got me through the COVID and everything and parenting. My life is not at all what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Right. And I don't know what it's going to be in 10 years. And so for me, the biggest takeaway is improv can really help people really fully accept the people around them, their current situation. Not to say that you shouldn't be actively trying to make changes and, you know, you shouldn't have goals. Like that can coexist. Both things can be true. You can accept your current situation and make the best of it while also trying to get into a better situation.
You want to answer that? We're almost out of time here, Jen.
I just say yes and to that. I thought it was very well said.
Anything you want to add, Daniel?
Yes, and there are also times when closure is necessary because action is needed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in crisis, ambiguity is good, but there are also moments when taking action and making a choice, a strong choice, and shutting down all the other options sometimes has to happen. And hopefully those moments make themselves clear to us.
I think they do. Mm-hmm. Well, this was really fun, and I so appreciate all three of you joining us today on The Connection. Let me say thank you to Clay. I'm sorry you weren't with us here in our studio, but it was terrific to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's Clay Drinko. He's an educator, author of Play Your Way Sane and Theatrical Improvisation, Consciousness and Cognition. He writes about improv for Psychology Today. Danigal Young, social psychologist at the University of Delaware, author and improv comedian. Thank you, Danigal.
Thank you, Marty.
You're so welcome. And Jennifer Childs, co-founder and artistic director of 1812 Productions. Thanks so much for joining us on The Connection.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.